Cry Most Queer is an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa, intended for adult audiences and may contain graphic or disturbing content, including detailed descriptions of violence, physical or sexual assault, injuries to victims, and foul language. If you feel this may trigger you at all, please reconsider listening. If you need to talk to someone, please see our show notes for the contact numbers of crisis helplines around South Africa.
Welcome to Cry Most Queer. I'm NJ Hawkeby. So, in the second installment of our series on the use of the gay panic defence in South Africa, we turn our attention to the town of Strand on False Bay, about 50 kilometres southeast of Cape Town, where the discovery of Dr. Louis Haynes's body and the subsequent arrest of three men in the Swartland town of Malmesbury, about 70 kilometres inland from the mother city, in connection with his murder, would introduce South Africa's mainstream society to the concepts of cottaging and supposed straight men making use of the services of gay-for-pay male prostitutes. What makes this case especially heartbreaking for me is that, as a former rent boy, a vast majority of my clients were married men who felt the need to hide aspects of their lives from their friends, family, and colleagues. Personally, I don't know if I would have been able to do that. I told the world at large that I was gay when I was 18, and I've lived a very out and proud life ever since. I've championed queer rights and trans rights, and the right to live your truth, and I don't think I would have been able to live my life half in the shadows, faking it for the sake of my career, or my family, or my religion. But some people do. I'm not saying that Louis was or wasn't gay, that's not the point of the story. But it did shine a spotlight on what some men have to go through, even 2 decades into the new millennium. But let's crack on, shall we? There's a lot to unpack in part 2 of Gay Panic in South Africa, the bashing of Dr. Louis Haynes.
The hunt is still on for missing Cape Town pediatric specialist and Stellenbosch University lecturer Dr. Louis Haynes. He was last seen leaving his brother's home in Somerset West at about 8:20 on Wednesday evening and is believed to have gone missing on his way home to Welgelegen in Paro. According to Dr. Haynes's brother, Christo, he would have taken the N2, R300 and N1 highways to get home. When he hadn't arrived home by midnight and wasn't responding to text messages, his wife, Dalian, reported him missing. Police spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Andre Trout said on Sunday that police were investigating the circumstances surrounding his disappearance and that he was still regarded as a missing person. Nana Reshna, director of the Pink Ladies, an organization that helps find missing children, said that they had begun spreading the news of Dr. Haynes' disappearance on social media, and missing person flyers were being distributed along the route he is believed to have traveled. She added that they are doing all they can to locate him, but finding his car, a dark grey Peugeot 308, is crucial. His car registration is CY121038, and he was wearing a black golf shirt, brown pants and grey jacket at the time of his disappearance. Anyone with information should call Detective Warrant Officer Hannes Niemand at 021-85.
On May 22, 2013, just 5 days after Mbulelo Mthunzana was granted leave to appeal, on the other side of the country, some 1,250 kilometres away, another man mysteriously vanished. By all accounts, Dr. Louis Haynes was a man who had it all. A thriving career as one of the leading paediatric specialists in the country, based at Tygerberg Hospital. The admiration and respect of his students and colleagues at Stellenbosch University, where he was a lecturer in the medical faculty. A devoted wife of 33 years, and 3 loving adult children. It would take 7 days before the family would get any answers as to what had happened, but when they did, the answers didn't make any sense. For a week, a team of cleaners from the city of Cape Town worked the promenade that ran the length of Strand beachfront, totally oblivious to what lay nearby. Speaking to the Cape Argus, Johannes Hendricks, the cleaning crew supervisor, described their average day. At 7:30 in the morning, they would start by unlocking the public toilets near the putt-putt course. They would then walk the foot trails that crisscrossed the milkwood tree-covered sand dune separating the beach from Beach Road and clean up any litter that may have accumulated over the course of the previous day. They would then make their way along the promenade towards the Strand Pavilion, cleaning as they went. Once they reached the pavilion, they would then move onto the beach sand and make their way back to where they started, picking up litter as they walked, getting to the public toilets at around 4 p.m. The bathrooms would then be checked for occupants, then locked up for the night. Finally, the cleaning crew would clock out for the day and head home, returning the following morning to do it all over again. The loos were definitely nothing fancy. They were dingy and grimy and had been vandalized quite considerably. Graffiti covered the stall walls, some more graphic than others, but generally along the lines of
"For a great time, call."
Often, in amongst the ice cream wrappers and chip packets that littered the area, they would find used condoms, discarded drug paraphernalia, and abandoned items of clothing, such as men's underwear. As for the goings-on, the cleaning crew claimed that they would, occasionally, hear the sound of more than one man coming from behind the cubicle door. No pun intended. You see, the bathrooms down this end of the Strand beachfront were renowned in certain circles as a cruising spot for gay men, and a place where rent boys would ply their trade. It wasn't the safest of areas either. One former male prostitute named Ivan, whose number had been scrawled on the wall in the bathroom, said that he'd worked the area before, but it had become quite dangerous and he ended up leaving the profession to become a farm labourer, although he didn't want to reveal where. The business owners and residents in the area knew full well what the facility was being used for, and they would often chase away horny men and desperate boys in search of anonymous sex or a fast buck. And yet the cops claimed to be totally unaware of the area's reputation. Yeah, right. Just a few months earlier, in August 2012, the Cape Argus ran an article labeling a, quote, "blatant male prostitution ring," end quote, working that exact stretch of beachfront between the Life Saving Club and the Putt-Putt Course. The article reported that the newspaper had been approached by four separate sources who wished to voice their disgust at the situation. But according to a piece published in response on the gay news website Mumba Online, the article was just a shocking display of shoddy journalism, intended to, quote, "subtly link homosexuality to sexual perversion," end quote, and was little more than scaremongering. According to one source for the Argus article, her 13-year-old son had been approached by a man on the beach, although, as Mumba Online rightfully pointed out, why a 13-year-old boy would be seen as a viable client by a male prostitute wasn't explained. No, it seems more likely that Mummy Dearest was trying to suggest that pedophiles, prostitutes and pufters were all one and the same thing. The article also reported that there had been many cases of men flagrantly masturbating in front of children on the beach, and yet the article was void of any quotes from police sources, or any other experts for that matter. Where the police were mentioned was that the Life Saving Club was working with the local neighbourhood watch, and they were in permanent radio contact with the South African Police Service to try and deal with the scourge of such shocking perversion. So yeah, of course, the police had absolutely no idea. That sounds legit. What say you, coppers? Right. That's what I thought. But let's put my skepticism on this aside for the moment and give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say, for argument's sake, that on Monday, May 27th, 2013, the police indeed were blissfully unaware of any alleged shenanigans. By Tuesday, the 28th, they knew full well what went down there. Investigators were told in no uncertain terms what went on, and they were led onto the dune, just a few meters away from the public toilets. And there, underneath the low-hanging branches of a milkwood tree, in a shallow sandy grave, they uncovered the rapidly decomposing body of Dr. Louis Haynes. Let's take a step back in time and meet the subject of the sad tale. Dr. Louis Haynes was born in early June 1953. He proved to be exceptionally bright, and pretty early on, he set his sights on becoming a doctor. He matriculated from Tigerberg High School in 1971 and enrolled at Stellenbosch University, obtaining his Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery degree in 1977. It was also during this time that he met his future wife, Lillian. During the apartheid years, military service was mandatory, and Louis served as a military doctor from 1979 to 1981, posted at various missionary hospitals and at Two Military Hospital, more commonly known as TUMO, in Cape Town. He and Lillian eventually married in 1981, a few months before he took up a position in the pediatric intensive care unit at Tigerberg Hospital in 1982. The couple would have three children, sons Charles and Daniel, and daughter Eldelay. This was a happy family. Getting to the top of your game and becoming a leading pediatric specialist is not easy when you have a family at home. But Louis managed to find that balance, and he still found the time to play an active role in his children's lives, despite the long hours and dedication that advancing in his career and furthering his education demanded. Louis obtained a diploma in child health in 1986, a diploma in community health in 1988, and a Bachelor of Science honors in epidemiology and statistics in 1990. In 1996, he obtained his Master's of Philosophy in maternal and child health, and a Master of Philosophy in health science education in 2011. He would remain at Tigerberg Hospital for his entire career, a total of more than 30 years, initially as a medical officer and subsequently as a consultant, and he was integral in the running of the tracheostomy unit and home care program. As a lecturer at Stellenbosch University, he was very involved in both undergraduate and postgraduate medical education, and served as the examiner in two diploma in child health examinations in 2011 and 2012. According to his obituary in the September 2013 edition of the College Chronicle, the newsletter of the South African College of Pediatricians, at the time of his untimely death, he was the diplomate representative of the Council of Pediatricians and had served on the Colleges of Medicine Senate in the same capacity in the previous triennium. He was an experienced advanced pediatric life support instructor, and a great passion of his was teaching resuscitation skills to students, doctors, nurses, and paramedics. He was active in outreach activities and served as chair of the Tigerberg Hospital School Board, was a board member of Marty Community Service, and was also the Departmental Occupational Health and Safety Representative for both the hospital and the medical faculty. After his death, tributes poured in from all corners of the medical profession. Robin Green, the editor of the College Chronicle, called him, quote, the most amazingly caring person who was well-loved by patients, parents, students, and staff. His passing left a massive void in pediatrics in South Africa and in our hospital and department in particular, end quote. Dr. Julie Morrison, a colleague at Tigerberg Hospital, said that anyone who worked with Dr. Haynes loved him. Quote, no one ever had a bad word to say about him. He did so much for the hospital, end quote. One of his colleagues at Stellenbosch University described him as, quote, a committed doctor and lecturer who dedicated his life to service, end quote. Okay, so as you can tell, the guy was the absolute salt of the earth. And ordinarily, this is where I would dive into the lives of the perpetrators. But this story is pretty convoluted. I mean, one victim, 2 years in court, three defendants, four lawyers and five judges. Trying to keep shit straight while researching the story was a challenge in itself. So, let's break with tradition and move on to the events of May the 22nd, 2013. We can unpack the backstories of the three accused as we go along. It had been a long day, and as Louis was packing up, he placed a call to Lillian. He told her that he had just finished his last lecture and would be stopping by their son's place in Somerset West before heading home. But on arriving at Charles' house, he discovered that his son wasn't at home. Seeing as he was in the area, he decided instead to call in at his brother, Christu, who lived in a gated community in another part of Somerset West. Louis let Lillian know the change of plans, and the two men spent the next few hours shooting the shit, before Louis announced at around 8 p.m.
Time I went home because I have to prepare for class.
Those would be among the last words that Christo would ever hear his brother say. Half an hour later, Louis' grey Peugeot would be caught on the guardhouse's security cameras, driving out of the complex, heading towards the N2 highway. The car was again spotted on highway CCTV cameras, driving on the N2, and then again on a traffic camera in Helderview. But then it disappeared. When by midnight Louis still wasn't home, Dalian sent him a text asking if everything was all right, but clearly everything was as far from all right as you can get. When the SMS went unanswered, Dalian called Christo, who let her know that Louis had left 4 hours earlier. Thus started Dalian's 8-day living nightmare. But what actually happened? We don't really know for sure. The defence's story was wholly rejected by the prosecution when the case went to trial. But that's the only sequence of events we have to go on. So let me run through how the defence said things played out. The section of Strand Beach around the Putt-Putt course had a bad reputation. It was a known hangout of drug dealers, male prostitutes or street rents, and cottagers, men who have sex in public bathrooms, and was the bane of local residents' and business owners' lives. The Van der Velde brothers, 32-year-old Martinez, also known as Tian, and 43-year-old Sorrel, had bought alcohol, vodka coolers for Tian and beers for Sorrel, and Tian had bought himself some tuck, a cheap, low-quality form of crystal meth, and they'd made their way down to the beachfront to partake of their purchases. The men had a reputation of their own among the residents of Malmesbury, a farming community 70 kilometers northeast of Cape Town. They single-handedly kept the town's rumour mill grinding on, with stories about them ranging from them coming from a wealthy family from Uppington in the Northern Cape who had lost everything, a theory I strongly doubt, to them working as street rents to support their drug habit, which is less hard to believe. Most people who knew them did their best to avoid them, especially Tian, whose own mother, Marie Buerta, described him as rotten and thoroughly bad. While Sorrel had managed to stay on the right side of the law, Tian had dedicated more than half of his years to a life of crime. From the age of 15 back in 1995, Tian had chalked up quite the rap sheet, including robbery, housebreaking, and car theft. This last one was linked to another murder investigation back in 2007, in which a Stellenbosch socialite, Montgomery Pullman, was thrown off a cliff south of Gordon's Bay the next time on from Strand. I'm not going to go into too much detail here because I want to cover this particular case in a future episode, but suffice to say, Tian was sentenced to 5 years for the theft of Pullman's vehicle, and had only just been released from prison 4 months earlier. On his release, he'd moved into the Haven night shelter where his mother and brother were staying. This didn't last long, and in February, for reasons unknown, he and his mother were kicked out, but not his brother. Sorrel remained at the shelter and worked at the scrapyard next door, owned by a local businessman, Juan Liederman. After their eviction, Tian and Marie then moved in with Tian's girlfriend, Joanna Solomon. I couldn't find out when Tian had moved out, why he'd moved out, or where he'd moved to, but I assume their relationship with Joanna ran its course and they broke up. But when he moved out, his mother did not. Around the same time, Sorrel was accused by Jean Liederman of stealing and was fired. I assume, although I don't know for sure, that being unable to afford to stay on at the Haven, Sorrel had to find alternative accommodation. And he and Tian found a place to stay together. But again, where is anybody's guess, as this was never revealed in any of the news reports of the case. Okay, back to that night. According to Tian, he and Sorrel were drinking, and in Tian's case getting high, on Strand Beach, when a dark grey Peugeot 308 pulled up. Louis Haynes got out and walked over to the men. They got chatting, and Louis asked what their rates were. Tian gave him his price and he and Louis walked off into the bushes that covered the sand dune to take care of business. They entered a clearing in the bushes and Louis felt Tian's dick through his pants. However, thanks to the drugs in Tian's system, there was a distinct lack of personal growth, if you get my meaning, and no amount of attention managed to get Tian to, well, attention. Finally, in disgust, Louis took a step back and sneered.
"You beg me to pay you? But your penis won't even get out."
Sidebar. A little bit of info on the effects of crystal meth. Besides being anti-Viagra, it also makes the user paranoid, irrational, and quick to anger, which makes what happened next unsurprising. End sidebar. The insult to his moneymaker sent Tian into a fit of rage. He punched Louis in the throat, and the man staggered backwards. Tian leapt forward, punching him a second time, this time landing a blow on the side of Louis' head. Louis fell to the ground, and Tian started to kick him repeatedly and stamped down on his head and chest. Hearing the commotion, Saul came running into the clearing. The scene he came upon struck him dumb, but finally he found his voice. He shouted at Tian to stop, but his younger brother didn't even acknowledge Saul's pleas. When Tian dropped onto Louis' chest and wrapped his hands around the older man's throat, Saul realized he needed to do something. At the risk of his brother turning on him, Saul flung his arms around Tian and forcibly pulled him off. The two brothers flopped back onto the sand as Saul held on for dear life until Tian finally calmed down. Tian eventually said that they needed to tie Louis up. He stripped the shoelaces from Louis' shoes and unbuckled Louis' belt and pulled it from his pants. The two then proceeded to tie Louis' hands and feet, but when Tian felt for a pulse, there wasn't one, and the paranoia kicked in. He rifled through Louis' pockets and grabbed the dead man's car keys, phone and wallet. Then the two brothers raced to Louis' car. Tian unlocked the door and sprang into the driver's seat. Saul jumped into the passenger seat and the two men sped away in the direction of Gordon's Bay. They wanted to sell the car, but not having the registration papers would make this difficult. And it did. When they failed to find a buyer, the men returned to the scene of the crime. Digging a hole in the soft sand beneath the milkwood tree with their bare hands, they dragged the body into the depression. Tian removed a gold ring from Louis' finger before covering the body with beach sand, making sure nothing was exposed. They then climbed back into the Peugeot and made their way to Malmesbury via Stellenbosch, making sure to avoid major highways and their network of traffic cameras. While driving, Sorrel started rummaging through the various nooks and crannies in the car, which was when he discovered Louis' ID tag for Tigerberg Hospital. This only made Tian's paranoia worse. His driving became more erratic until Sorrel finally told him to pull over and let him drive. With the men now having traded places, Tian took another hit of crystal meth to calm his nerves, and then he took out Louis' wallet. He removed the bank cards and the SIM card from Louis' phone and tossed everything out of the window as they passed through Khayelitsha. The drugs were having the desired calming effect on Tian, but the strain started to get to Sorrel. At about 4:20 when they arrived in Malmesbury, Sorrel was a wreck, and Tian called his ex-girlfriend Joanna, asking if they could stop by for coffee. When she answered the door, they went straight to their mother's room. What was discussed between Marie and her sons remains a mystery, but they left a short while afterwards, and what they did for the rest of the day is unknown. However, Tian returned later that evening, without Saul, and asked for something to eat. Joanna gave him some bread, and when he had finished eating, he got up and said he needed to fetch something outside. Then Joanna heard an engine start, and when she looked out of her front door, she saw the taillights of a car driving away, and Tian was nowhere to be seen. She found this odd, as she knew neither Tian nor Sorrel owned a car, but it was too dark to make out the make or model. The following day, Tian called, asking her to get hold of Sorrel and tell him to come over to her house, which she did. When he arrived, he seemed nervous and immediately started scratching through her cupboards. When she asked what he was looking for, he responded that he wanted a calming tablet. When asked why, he replied in Afrikaans,
"Because Tian killed a man."
She was shocked and demanded to know what had happened. Sorrel told her what had transpired 2 nights before, that his brother had hit a man in the throat, and after the man collapsed, he had trodden down on the man's head. When Tian arrived later on foot, he and Sorrel argued. Tian demanded that Sorrel go and sell a car jack at the scrapyard where Sorrel previously worked, because Tian needed money for petrol. When Sorrel had refused, Tian yelled at him, saying,
"We call shit together, but when things get difficult, you turn your back."
Tian then stormed out of the house. Later that day, Joanna sent him a text demanding to know if what Sorrel had said was true, that he'd killed a man. He texted back,
"You always believe whatever other people tell you."
Sorrel met up with Tian later, and they went together to see Joan Lederman to discuss selling the car. Joan had no idea that the car was stolen. The brothers neglected to mention that juicy bit of information, and he didn't bother to ask. But the trio eventually struck a deal. Jean would take the car off their hands for 1,000 rand and a carton of cigarettes, and he agreed to pay them more once they turned over the registration papers. As much as I want to believe that Juan Lederman was just an unfortunate soul, caught up in the bullshit story peddled to him by two men at whose hands a respected and adored medical practitioner had lost his life, we will never know why Juan did what he did next. In a move that made him look guilty as fuck, Juan instructed that the dark grey Peugeot 308, a car that was in perfectly good running order, be chopped up for parts. The net, however, was closing in. Using Louis' cell phone records and the handset's GPS locator, the cops managed to track down the phone's movements, and on Tuesday, May the 27th, police, led by Detective Warrant Officer Hannes Niemand, knocked on Tian and Saro's door. The brothers were taken into custody, and as they were being transported to Somerset West Police Station, Tian became emotional. He said he needed to clear his conscience. Detective Niemand informed him of his rights. He had the right to remain silent, the right to an attorney, and the privilege against self-incrimination. But Tian replied,
"I want to make my heart clean."
Tian confessed to the murder of Dr. Louis Haynes, initially saying that he had attacked Dr. Haynes when the man had approached him and Sorrel, asking about their rent boy rates. Then he led police officers to the shallow grave on the dune at Strand Beach and told them the whereabouts of Louis' Peugeot 308. For 8 days, Dalian Haynes had no idea what had happened to the loving, caring, dependable man she'd been married to for more than 3 decades. But now she knew. As SABC News reported on the morning of June the 2nd, 2013,
this is where the Stellenbosch University-based professor's body was found. One of three suspects led police here. He had been questioned about Haynes' mysterious disappearance last Wednesday.
Police officers worked around the clock and managed to trace the dark grey Peugeot vehicle who belongs to Dr. Haynes to a chop shop in Malmesbury. They arrested three suspects from Malmesbury, aged 32 to 43 years of age.
The family is very, very shocked. I have a loving sister who lost a very loving husband. He was involved with patients at the Tigerberg Hospital for so many, many years, where he worked in the as a pediatrician. He was a lecturer.
Stellenbosch University says his death is a great loss to the medicine faculty.
Dr. Ainge was a very beloved colleague and very popular with the under and postgraduate students. He's been working in this hospital for nearly 36 years, dedicating his life to the critically ill.
The suspects are expected to appear in court today.
Yes, she knew that her husband had been murdered, and she knew where his body had been found. But the circumstances surrounding his death left her baffled. Why there, and what could possibly have brought him together with these two men? According to Dalian, her brother Andre, her brother-in-law Christo, her children Charles, Elderley and Daniel, and a number of Louis' friends and colleagues, there was absolutely zero reason for Louis to have gone to that particular part of Strand Beach. At no point had Louis given any of them even the slightest reason to question his sexuality or his fidelity. And this is what makes this a crime most queer. Neither the victim nor the three co-accused identified as gay. And yet this crime had all the signs of a hate crime. An older man savagely beaten to death in an area notorious for clandestine homosexual encounters by a younger man, possibly posing as a male prostitute. After the Ntlantla Gaza murder a few months before, it wasn't that much of a stretch to assume that this was just more of the same. And this was precisely the angle that both queer and mainstream media went for. Darby Nell, the director of OUT, an LGBTQ health, wellness and activist organisation in Pretoria, speaking to the Star newspaper, said that gay men are seen by society as pedophiles and promiscuous people who force themselves on straight men, and when they are attacked and killed by those men, they are believed to have deserved whatever happened to them. After all, they had dared to approach a straight man, and when these straight men kill men they believe to be gay, they often fall back on dangerous stereotypes in an attempt to justify their actions. Referring to both the killings of Garza and Haynes, he said both of the accused tried to justify their actions by claiming that their victim had approached them with inappropriate intent. Also, with research showing South Africa as one of the most homophobic countries in the world, despite our progressive constitution, it shouldn't come as a surprise that these crimes often have an element of opportunism to them, especially when the victim is known to be heterosexual, but found to engage sexually with other men. The perpetrators may see their victims as a soft target. If they lure their victim in with the promise of sex and then rob them or assault them, the likelihood of their victim reporting the crime to the police is slim, as doing so could expose the context in which the crime happened. Essentially, the victim is a victim twice over, once during the actual crime, and again due to the oppression that comes of society's deep-seated homophobia, because they are fearful of the public's reaction should that particular aspect of their life become known. The gay panic defence is nothing new in South Africa. According to Professor Sean Nell, a professor of psychology at the University of South Africa, who has published many articles exploring hate crimes against gay men, men who tried to use the gay panic defence are pinning their hopes on the notoriously patriarchal, mildly, or not so mildly, homophobic justice system, taking pity on them for the psychological and emotional trauma they have suffered at the hands of these sick, twisted faggots. Surely they can't be blamed for lashing out. They were the victims here, after all. And again, this is unsurprising. The apartheid days, pre-1994, were notoriously homophobic. Lest we forget, ours is a country where homosexual men would be subjected to torture and in some cases forced gender reassignment surgery by our own military. And the courts would often use being solicited by a homosexual as a mitigating factor in a crime, which could see an offender getting a more lenient sentence. And it's not that uncommon a defence in the killings of undeniably straight men either. When Eugene Terreblanche, the infamously homophobic, racist, right-wing leader of the Afrikaner nationalist organisation the AWB, was hacked to death in his bed in April 2010, his killer, Isaac Mhlangu, claimed that old Eugene had come onto him sexually. Yeah, the entire country collectively rolled their eyes at that one. Similarly, the family of Louis Haynes denied emphatically that Louis was in any way, shape or form a whoopsie. And while I'm not here to out anyone or tell the family that they are wrong, I have a friend. He is around the same age as Louis Haynes would be now. He and his wife have been married for over 40 years. They have two beautiful children and four adorable grandchildren. He enjoys music and theatre and socialising over good wine and good food. To all intents and purposes, my friend is the poster child for refined, sophisticated, straight white male. In reality, he's anything but. He goes to men-only sex clubs and engages with other men on the lowdown, and has told me that he would never come out to his family because it would shatter them. This, despite the family having many openly gay friends. He comes from an era, as did Louis Haynes, where getting married and having children was expected. What you did after hours, in the shadows, was nobody's business but your own, provided it never became public knowledge. And if it did, you would be publicly humiliated and ostracized. Hell, it was this very culture of sneaking around behind the backs of your spouse, children, friends, and colleagues that made fucking a public loser a thing. If anything, the mindset of people like those who bitched to the Cape Argus in 2012 about the goings-on at the public toilets on Strand Beach is precisely the reason why those public toilets were being used as a hookup spot by closeted gay men in the first place. As I said, I'm not here to out anyone, but there is a good chance that Louis Haynes was really good at hiding his other life. The same could be said for Louis, as was said of Nhlanhla Garza. If anyone wanted to know if Louis was gay, they lost their chance, because only Louis knew the real answer to the question of his sexuality. When police arrived at Johan Lederman's scrapyard in Malmesbury, they discovered Louis' Peugeot already being dismantled, which didn't make Johan look like an innocent victim of both circumstance and the Van der Walt boys. He was arrested and charged with robbery. The brothers were charged with robbery and murder, and all three men appeared in court on Monday, June the 2nd. During this court appearance, it was revealed that Tiaan van der Walt had no fewer than 13 previous convictions, mostly for housebreaking and theft, dating back almost two decades. The court also heard that he had only recently, on January the 26th, gotten out of Polsmoor prison on the vehicle theft charge linked to Montgomery Pullman's murder back in 2007. Tiaan had been sentenced to 5 years behind bars and served out his full sentence before his release, having been denied parole. The court also learnt that John Lederman's lawyer, William Booth, would be applying for bail on behalf of his client, an application that the state said it would oppose. The state also requested that proceedings be postponed for a week while they assessed the case and settled on the charges to be brought against the three men. Elsewhere in the investigation, three other men, aged between 22 and 29, including a police officer, were also taken in for questioning in connection with Louis' murder. On Friday, June the 7th, hundreds of mourners packed the Tygerberg Evangelical Reformed Church in Belleville, where one after the other, friends and colleagues paid moving tributes to the slain doctor and offered words of condolence to his family. When the Tygerberg Hospital choir sang, Lillian dropped her face into her hands and wept. Professor Sharon Kling, a colleague of 22 years, remembered Louis as
a gentle giant of a man, with a reputation for eating the nurse's sandwiches and the patient's leftover food. If we could not find Louis in the intensive care unit, we knew he would be in the sisters' tea room or in the kitchen. Ward A9,
Tygerberg's neonatal intensive care unit,
will never be the same again.
Tygerberg pediatric professor Robert Gee said,
"Today we are all very sad. Dr. Hames taught basic and advanced life support courses to all medical students at the University of Stellenbosch. Tens of thousands of people. All of them would have been infected by his attitude. He joined in 1984, and over the last 20 years, he was a wonderful colleague, an exceptional and caring physician, and best of all, a people's person. Louis knows everybody, and everybody loved and knew Louis."
Professor Marianne Krier, head of Stellenbosch University's Department of Pediatrics and Child Health, said people had arrived at Tygerberg Hospital spontaneously after the news broke because they wanted to be where Louis' soul had last been. Quote, "The man was a miracle and they all wanted to honour him," end quote. Also in attendance was Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who, along with his wife Leah, is a patron of Tygerberg Hospital. After the service, he briefly addressed the media, describing Louis as, quote, "such a wonderful symbol of our country," end quote. He spoke of the reaction to the news of Louis' passing, saying that his previous patients had come to the hospital when they heard what had happened, because he touched the hearts of so many people. Quote, "He represented the South Africa we know we can be. Skin color is nothing. It's a person's heart that is everything," end quote. The following Monday, the three men appeared before Magistrate N.B. Magutwa at the Somerset West Magistrates Court, which was filled with family, friends and the media, with some, like Nurse Sarah Fish, one of Louis' colleagues from Tygerberg Hospital, speaking to an ENCA reporter ahead of the trial.
"Justice must prevail. We think the police are doing a very good job. Arrests were made quickly and we don't want any time to be wasted on this matter. These people must get what they deserve because they've taken a wonderful person from us."
With proceedings finally getting underway, it proved to be a remarkably busy day in courtroom A, with Tiaan and Sol's lawyer, Henk Carstens, getting things going by telling the court that his clients had been assaulted while in police custody. He claimed that Tiaan had injuries all over his body, and Sorrel had been beaten up and had pains in his head, which made it difficult for him to concentrate. Allegedly, they were also both probed and shocked with, quote, "an electric object," end quote. Carstens asked that the court allow the brothers to be examined by a district surgeon because, he claimed, the prison doctor was not available. The court denied this application, but allowed the brothers to return to prison so they could see a doctor, whilst John Lederman conducted his bail application. Carstens also tried, unsuccessfully, to gain access to the statements, which he called confessions, that the brothers had made to the police after their arrest, and to the video recordings of these statements being made. When this bid failed, the brothers were led back to the holding cells beneath the court, from where they would be returned to Polsmoor Prison, to await their next appearance on August the 8th. The court then turned its focus to Juan Liederman and his lawyer, William Booth, as they began the process of Juan's bail application. The National Prosecuting Authority advised the court that they had revised the charges against Juan to accessory to robbery after the fact and defeating the ends of justice. Both of these are Schedule 6 offences, which meant that the onus fell on Juan to provide exceptional circumstances to warrant bail being granted. According to the state, Juan would stop at nothing to defeat the ends of justice. The state argued that Juan knew about the murder, but rather than reporting the crime to the police, he had instead dismantled Louis' Peugeot and hid or destroyed pieces of the car that could have been used as evidence. According to NPA's spokesman, Eric Ntabalazia,
we felt that we needed to oppose bail because this is a Schedule 6 matter. That's where how we charge him. And we've put it to the defense to prove that he deserved to be out on bail.
Booth, however, told the court that Juan was not a flight risk, was well respected in the community, and was the sole provider for his family. He also informed the court that Juan had been subjected to threats from his co-accused both before and after his arrest, including while the trio were incarcerated at Posmore awaiting trial. Juan said he knew the men from when Sorrel had worked for him, but he had let Sorrel go a month before the murder because he believed that Sorrel had stolen from the business. Juan said that the threats started soon afterwards. This raises the question why Juan agreed to take the car off them, or indeed conduct any business whatsoever with the brothers. But this question seems to have gone unasked and unanswered. In an affidavit submitted to the court by Juan and read out by Booth, Juan related how, when the three men were transferred to Polsmore, the threats against Juan from the brothers resumed, and Juan told his family, who contacted Booth, who in turn informed the National Prosecuting Authority. Juan said he feared for both his life and that of his wife and two young children, because the brothers claimed to have certain contacts in prison who could harm him. Juan also said his wife was unemployed and he was paying maintenance for a daughter from a previous relationship. In addition, he was financially supporting his retired parents, and beside his scrapyard business, he owned 8 shops in the area, which he rented out monthly. Should he not be granted bail, he argued, his business would likely have to close down, affecting him and his staff. Booth said his client had been shocked to discover that the owner of the car that had been sold to him had been robbed and killed, and he denied emphatically having any knowledge of the murder when he took possession of the vehicle. Booth also revealed that Juan had a previous conviction for negligent driving, dating back many years, but said he should be considered a first offender. Juan's wife, Carlaine, also submitted an affidavit to the court, in which she detailed the trauma that the family had been through since her husband's arrest, and said his continued incarceration would extremely prejudice them. She insisted that her husband was an honest, law-abiding citizen and not a danger to society. Booth also requested that Juan's trial should be separated from the murder of Louis Haynes.
I have argued that he should certainly not be joined on the murder case. Well, there is no evidence to join him, and the state can't have his trial run together with the trial on the murder case. So they should separate that case completely.
The state was unconvinced by the defense's arguments.
We had those arguments today, and we felt strongly that the defense has failed to prove beyond any reasonable doubt.
Their reservations aside, the case was postponed for a week, when Juan would learn if his application had been successful. Then, a week later, this happened.
A free man for now. 37-year-old Juan Liederman released on bail nearly 2 weeks after his arrest. His lawyer says it's been a challenging time for both the accused and his family.
It's been quite a battle. He's been detained at Polsmore Prison, which is a horrific place. And we just, and the family are just very thankful that bail has eventually been fixed for him.
Liederman claims he wasn't involved in Haynes' death and didn't steal the doctor's car. His lawyer says they will apply for his case to be separated from the other two accused so that he doesn't have to endure a lengthy trial.
In an interesting change of heart by the National Prosecuting Authority, where you will recall they claimed that Juan would, quote, stop at nothing to defeat the ends of justice, end quote, they suddenly felt that Juan was a decent, upstanding fellow.
The MPA says it's convinced Liederman is not a flight risk.
The public needs to understand that bail is not punitive. It's just a way of saying that the accused must come back to court, and we are convinced he will come back to court.
Liederman's co-accused abandoned their bail application yesterday. Meanwhile, three suspects brought in for questioning last week have been released. One of them is a police officer.
Jean was released on 20,000 rand bail, but it would be more than a year before he would finally learn his fate. On June 26, 2014, Jean appeared alongside Carl and Tian in the Western Cape High Court, where he pleaded guilty to a charge of possession of stolen property as part of a plea agreement with the state. In his plea, Jean stated that when Tian brought the car to Jean's scrapyard in Malmesbury, he had no registration papers or documentation for the vehicle. But the two agreed to a cash payment of 1,000 rand and a carton of cigarettes until Tian could produce the papers. Jean admitted that he did not ask where the vehicle came from, how it had been obtained, or whether Tian was authorized to sell the car. He also stated that he was not aware that the car was stolen and was extremely shocked that Haynes had been murdered, but denied that he was involved in the murder in any way. Jean had initially faced a robbery charge, but in terms of the plea agreement, prosecutor Samantha Raffels amended the charge to one of not having reasonable cause to believe the property was properly acquired. As part of the agreement, Judge President John Schloppe sentenced Jean to pay a 10,000 rand fine or 5 years imprisonment. Half of the fine and the sentence would be suspended for a period of 5 years on condition that Jean was not convicted of a related offence in this time. Judge Schloppe also granted a separation of trial. Jean paid the fine of 5,000 rand and returned home to Malmesbury in relative obscurity. According to prosecutor Raffels, the Haynes family was disappointed by the relatively light sentence that Jean received, but they were willing to accept it, with the understanding that concessions had to be made, that they were to see justice for their husband and father when it came to the prosecution of Louis's killers. Meanwhile, the Van der Velde brothers' trial was set to begin on October 6th, where they would be prosecuted for kidnapping, robbery with aggravating circumstances, and murder, but there would be no going home for them. They were remanded into custody at Polsmoor Prison until their next court date. Many photographs were taken of Sorrel and Tian when their trial resumed in the Western Cape High Court in October 2014. And two things stood out that, in hindsight, were very telling. First was Tian's demeanour. The man seemed utterly carefree, leaning over to whisper something in his brother's ear, a half smile on his face. If we didn't know any better, the two men could have been snapped having a casual conversation while waiting for a bus. That is until you looked at Sorrel's body language, which was the second thing. You got a very different impression then. The man's brow was creased with worry. His expression, whenever he caught a camera trained on him, was pained. This was a man with the weight of the world on his shoulders. And so it wasn't really a surprise that Sorrel was the one to come clean as to the extent of his involvement. On October the 21st, Sorrel pleaded guilty to a lesser charge in a plea agreement with the state. And in so doing, Sorrel implicated his younger brother for the murder of Dr. Louis Haynes. State Prosecutor Samantha Raffels requested a separation of trial, and Judge Nape de Lomo ruled that Tian van der Velde would appear before another court on February the 23rd, 2015. Until such time, he would remain behind bars. As part of the plea agreement, the kidnapping charge against Sorrel was dropped, and the charges were amended to being an accessory after the fact of the murder. He also agreed to testify as a state witness at his brother's trial. On the day Haynes died, according to Sorrel, the brothers were in the Strand area near the Putback course, drinking alcohol. At around 8:30 p.m., they encountered Dr. Haynes. Tian soon began arguing with him and assaulted him, violently kicking and hitting him. Sorrel watched his brother kill Haynes and then helped to move the body. Judge Delormo sentenced Sorrel to 7 years in prison for his role in the crime, and a further 3 years for theft, acknowledging that the brothers took Haynes's Peugeot 308, which Sorrel drove at one stage and later sold to Schwan. Delamo ruled that the sentences would run concurrently, adding that he was, quote, satisfied that it is a just sentence, end quote. Sorrell will be eligible for parole later this year. When consulted by prosecutor affairs, the Haynes family said that they were satisfied with the sentence, that justice had been served. They could now turn their attention to the trial, and with any luck conviction, of the man who had so callously taken the life of their beloved Louis. Right, so two convictions down, one to go. It's time for the main event, the trial of Martinus van der Walt. I feel like we should have some sort of sound effect here. If only there was something... That'll do. Tian returned to court in February 2015, where he pleaded not guilty to the charges brought against him, namely kidnapping, robbery and murder. The state claimed that Louis had been ambushed at a traffic light while driving home from his brother's house, and that Tian and Sorrel had forced him to drive to Strand Beach, where he had then been led onto the dune and assaulted. A date in early May was set for the start of the trial, and on May the 11th, 2015, appearing before Judge André de Lachancy, Tian's new lawyer, Gerard Ferry, read out his plea explanation, where Tian insisted that Louis had approached him and his brother while they were drinking on the promenade and asked them for their race for sex. This had angered Tian, and he had proceeded to attack Louis. According to Tian, he punched and kicked Louis over and over, but had no intention of killing him. It was only after he discovered that Louis was dead that he got Sorrel to help him tie Louis' hands and feet and took Louis' car. There'd been no hijacking, no kidnapping, and Louis' death had been accidental, so at best, he was guilty of culpable homicide, not murder. Then the state called its first witness, Louis' widow, Dalian. In her testimony, she rejected Tian's claims that her husband had gone to Strand Beach that night in search of sex, saying that not once, in all the years she had known him, before and after they got married, had she ever had any reason to doubt her husband's loyalty or sexuality. There was no reason in her mind for her husband to have gone anywhere near Strand Beach that night, so he must have been taken there under duress. Next, Tian's ex-girlfriend, Joanna Solomon, went into the witness box. She recalled the early morning visit the morning after the murder when Tian and Sorrel arrived at her door at 4:20 a.m. The anguish that Sorrel exhibited over the subsequent days and his eventual admission to her that Tian had murdered a man on the beach. She claimed to have seen Tian drive away from her house when she knew that neither he nor Sorrel owned a car. She told of the heated conversation between the brothers where Tian accused Sorrel of being willing to cause shit together but lacking the backbone to stick by him when said shit hit the fan. She spoke of their conversation where she confronted Tian about what he had done, and he dismissed her, implying that she was gullible and believed everything she was told, only to revisit the topic the following week and have Tian recount the events of that evening, detailing what he had done. The next day, May the 12th, Tian, his defense team, the state prosecutors, Judge Lachancy, and members of Louis' family visited for the first time the site where the body was discovered. The prosecution believed that visiting the site would give the court a better understanding of what had happened. When the trial resumed back in the High Court the following morning, the state called Dr. Daphne Anthony to the witness box. Dr. Anthony was the forensic pathologist who had conducted the post-mortem on Louis' body. She testified that the body was already in the early stages of decomposition when she received it. She also noticed signs that Louis had been tied up and strangled, and she found several blunt traumas and bruising all over Louis' body. In her expert opinion, Louis had died as a result of blunt force trauma to the head, neck, chest, abdomen and extremities, with contributing manual and ligature strangulation. The state's next witness was the investigating officer, Detective Warrant Officer Hannes Niemand. He again claimed to have been blissfully unaware that the area in which Louis' body was found was a well-known gay cruising spot, saying that he had lived in the area his entire life and had only ever known the spot to be a popular area for social gatherings and bries. Neon spoke of the investigation, where police had used cell phone records to track the brothers to their home in Malmesbury, where they were taken into custody and transported back to Somerset West Police Station. However, while they drove, Tian became emotional and said that he wanted to, quote, make his heart clean, end quote. Niemand told the court that he explained Tian's rights to him and the man replied that he was prepared to take Nuant to the body. Court was then adjourned until the following day, when it was widely believed that Sorrel van der Walt would make good on his plea agreement and testify against his brother. The next day, however, Thursday, May the 14th, the state surprised everybody by closing his case without calling Sorrel to the witness box. They gave no reason for opting not to call him, save to say that they were making him available to the defence as a witness. On Friday, May 15th, the defence made a last-ditch attempt to have one of the charges against their client dropped. According to advocate Gert Fourie, the evidence against Tian on the kidnapping charge was merely circumstantial and not enough to secure a conviction. However, Judge Le Grancy dismissed the application and said he needed to weigh up the evidence of all the witnesses. Court was then adjourned until May the 17th, when Tian would give his side of the story. Testifying in Afrikaans, Tian told the court how he and his brother had travelled from Malmesbury earlier in the day. When they got to Strand, they had bought booze, beer for Sorrel and vodka coolers for Tian, and Tian had obtained tuk, aka crystal meth, weed and mandrakes for himself, but Sorrel had only had alcohol. At around 8:30 that evening, Louis drove up and parked his Peugeot. He then walked over to the brothers, who were sitting in a bushy area of the dune, drinking and drugging. Louis had inquired about Tian's rates, and the two men then walked off into the bushes to conduct their business transaction. Few issues here. Firstly, goodbye Cape Panic defense. Tian seems to just abandon his claim that he lost his shit at the insinuation that he was a rent boy. Instead, he said that he had gone off willingly with Louis, and had only attacked him when Louis had scoffed at his inability to get it up. Secondly, Louis had no cash on him, a fact that Tian actually testified to. So, how exactly was Louis going to pay Tian for services rendered? Tian couldn't answer when this exact question was put to him during cross-examination. Back to Tian's testimony. Louis's mockery of Tian's flaccid dick enraged him, and Tian punched and kicked Louis repeatedly, all over his body.
I was just angry. I can't say how long I hit him for. That is when I realized I had seriously injured him. It was wrong. It wasn't my intention to do something like that.
Tian laid the blame for his actions on the drugs and alcohol.
My thoughts were not clean and pure. Tuk makes you angry and argumentative. Sometimes, it makes you a bit paranoid. If it wasn't for the drugs, what happened wouldn't have happened.
The court then heard that Sorrel pulled him off Louis, and once he had calmed down, Tian had used Louis's belt and shoelaces to tie Louis up while he was on the ground. He then felt for a pulse, but there was none.
I didn't know what to do. My paranoia told me that the police wouldn't believe me no matter what I told them.
He then detailed how they had taken Louis's car keys, wallet and phone, and fled in the Peugeot, but later returned to make sure that Louis was actually dead before burying the body. Tian insisted, however, that the murder was accidental. He had not killed Louis to steal his car. Sorrel at one point took over behind the wheel, and while they drove, Tian replaced Louis' SIM card with his own in Louis' phone, because his own phone's battery was dead and he needed to make calls. Trying to get rid of the car without the registration papers proved difficult, and a few days after the murder, Tian had gotten hold of a police acquaintance of his to ask his advice. It was never confirmed in the press, and what said advice was never made it into the papers, but I assume that this was the same police officer who had been taken in for questioning shortly after Tian's arrest. I also assume that the cop, if he was worth his salt, would have told Tian to hand himself in. Clearly, that was advice that Tian chose to reject. But be that as it may, Tian expressed his remorse in court.
I know what I did was wrong. I never intended for him to die.
Judge Le Grancy asked Tian if he was aware that it was possible for a man to kill someone through assault.
I have never seen that. It's normally if it's a bunch of people who do that.
Prosecutor Raffles picked up the line of questioning.
Did you know that death could be caused by kicking someone in the head?
Yes.
And how about the chest and the stomach?
Perhaps if you hurt them very badly.
And when you assaulted the man at this stage, all over his body, what did you think would happen?
I didn't know what would happen. I wasn't thinking properly. I was drunk and high.
Advocate Raffles was unconvinced by Tian's claims that he was flying on autopilot the night of the murder.
Can we accept that, that night, you weren't so confused that you didn't know what you were doing?
I can remember some things, but not everything. My mind isn't clear.
Before being allowed to step down, Judge Lechransi asked Tian to repeat what he claimed had started the argument.
The doctor brushed his hand over my pants and said, "You expect me to pay you, but your penis won't even get hard."
Tian was excused, and the defense rested their case. In her closing arguments in the Western Cape High Court on the morning of Wednesday, May the 20th, 2015, Prosecutor Samantha Raffles told the court that Tian was guilty of robbing Louis and of his murder, and that he had had direct intent to kill. She rejected Tian's claims that the doctor had approached him for sex, and then mocked his flaccid penis, saying that there was too many holes in his story, specifically pointing out that Louis had no money on him to pay Tian. She ended by asking the court to consider Tian's testimony improbable and untruthful. However, defense counsel Khad Faree argued that Tian had been under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and so he'd been unable to control himself when provoked by Louis's insult. It was the defense's view that the state had not been able to prove beyond reasonable doubt that Tian had in fact intended to kill Louis Haynes. Afterwards, the family addressed the media outside the court. Louis's brother-in-law, Andre Moten, described what he had heard in court as a, quote, Reva Steenkamp scenario, end quote, harking back to the then recent murder trial of Oscar Pistorius, saying that what had happened in Louis's final moments would probably remain a mystery as, quote, he was not here to speak for himself, end quote. Louis's wife Delian also called Tian's story into question, insisting that even after 33 years of marriage, not she, her friends, family, nor Louis's colleagues could believe that Louis would have solicited sex from another man. She also said that the trial had been difficult for all those who knew him, particularly his three children. His oldest son Charles and his wife were expecting their first child, and for Delian, welcoming their first grandchild into the world would be, quote, a bittersweet moment, end quote, because Louis was no longer there to share her joy. Judgment was set down for May the 26th. And that Tuesday, Tian stood in the dock as Judge Andre Lechransi read out his judgment, describing Tian's version of events as unconvincing, and despite Tian admitting that he had killed Dr. Haynes, his testimony was riddled with contradictions, fabrications, and outright lies. The judge pointed out that Tian had admitted to Louis having no money on him, which he said called into question Tian's claims that Louis wanted to know the price for sexual favours. He also said that Tian had overplayed the role of drugs and alcohol in the crime, and said that, in fact, the accused knew exactly what he was doing. Finally, he said that Tian's main motive was to steal the car, before finding him guilty of murder and robbery with aggravating circumstances, but acquitting him on the charge of kidnapping, saying that the state had not proved that Louis had been hijacked and then taken to Strand Beach. Tian stared straight ahead, expressionless, as Judge Lechransi delivered his judgment. But he covered his face with his hands when Louis's daughter, Aldele Swart, went into the witness box to give evidence in aggravation of sentence. She told the court her father was loving and caring, and that his death had left a terrible gap in the family. She recalled his passion for his job and how he never complained. Struggling to hold back her tears, she told the court how he had walked her down the aisle on her wedding day, just 6 months before he was murdered, and lamented that her father would not be there to welcome his first grandchild into the world the following month. She said that the family had been robbed of all those special moments, and it broke her heart to see her mother's future without her father. Next, Dr. Sharon Kling, Louis's colleague, took to the stand. She described him as a dedicated pediatrician who spent long hours at the intensive care unit at Tigerberg Hospital. She told the story of one girl in the tracheostomy unit who had stayed there for 20 years as she was permanently on a ventilator.
Louis would spend hours talking to her, and when he could,
he would take her home to visit her family with the aid of a mobile ventilator. The girl died last month.
Kling also said that Louis had been passionate about education.
He was more than a lecturer and teacher. He was a champion for students.
She said Louis's death had left a massive void in South African pediatrics. Outside the court, Liam was too emotional to speak to the media, but her brother said the family was coping well, but it was difficult because of the manner in which Louis had died. He also called Tian's conviction bittersweet and said he was hoping that Tian would be sentenced to life in prison when they returned to court on the 28th. Finally, more than two agonizing years after the disappearance and subsequent murder of Dr. Louis Haynes, the family would, at long last, get some closure. Wouldn't bring Louis back, but it would bring him justice. In passing sentence, Judge Lekhransi said that Tian was a career criminal who could not be rehabilitated, and he sentenced him to life imprisonment for murder dolus directus and a further 15 years for robbery with aggravating circumstances. He ordered that the sentences run concurrently. Louis's death, as Dr. Kling predicted, definitely left a gaping hole in the medical fraternity, and there are many parents in Cape Town and around the world who remember him fondly. It was never actually confirmed that Dr. Haynes was indeed gay, but the circumstances surrounding his death left a lot of unanswered questions. As I said earlier, it's not my place to speculate one way or the other, and almost 8 years later, does it really matter anyway? His family will remember him as irreplaceable. His colleagues will remember him as passionate and kind. His friends will remember him as dependable. Nobody will remember him as the closeted Morphe doctor. What shouldn't be forgotten, however, is how social bigotries were directly responsible for places like where Louis died becoming necessary. Had homosexuals not been forced to mainstream, a term used to describe conforming so as to avoid drawing attention to oneself, had they not been forced to marry, to live socially acceptable lives if they hope to advance in their careers, to live their truths under cover of darkness, to lie to the ones they hold dearest, cottaging and the like would probably never have become a thing. If Louis Haynes was indeed on Strand Beach that night looking for sex, mainstream society has as much blood in its hands as Tian van der Walt. As for the gay panic defense, even though Tian chose to abandon it during his trial, it is very much alive and well, as we will discover with our next case. However, unlike the cases we have discussed up to now, our next case proves that sometimes the gay panic defense actually fucking works. Thank you for joining me for the sad tale of the brutal killing of Dr. Louis Haynes. Again, I used a lot of sources and you can find the full list below the transcript on our website, acmq.co.za. I want to thank Nicole Engelbrecht, host of the True Crime South Africa podcast, for her guest appearance, and actually everybody who jumped in and offered their voice talent for this episode. This one was a lot of fun to make, and you guys certainly added to the experience. I'll be back again next time with the final installment of this three-part series, where we will look into the assault and murder of Siduduzu Buthelezi and the shocking turn of events surrounding his murder trial, which absolutely qualifies as a crime most queer.
You've been listening to A Crime Most Queer, an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa, presented by VA Amazing and written and produced by NJ Hawkerby and Janine McLean, with editorial oversight by Richard Thompson, original music by Joseph McDade, and additional voice talent by Janine McLean and others. See our show notes for more info. A Crime Most Queer is available on most podcasting platforms, including Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and others. Remember to subscribe on your podcast app of choice to be notified when we release new episodes. And if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, be sure to give us a rating and leave us a review. We really do appreciate hearing from you. If you would like to support the show, you can become a patron from just $1 per month by going to patreon.com/ACMQ podcast or make a one-off donation at paypal.me/ACMQ pod. We post all episodes along with additional content to our website, www.acmq.co.za. You can find us on social media by searching for A Crime Most Queer on Facebook and Twitter. We also welcome your thoughts, either on social media, or you can email us at comment@acmq.co.za. While this story is based on actual events, some situations, conversations, and characterizations may have been fictionalized or invented for purposes of dramatization, based on court documents and press reports from the time. With respect to such fictionalizations, any familiarity to actual character or history of any person, living or dead, is purely for dramatic purposes. Some names may have been changed to protect the identity of those involved.